So the problem, again, and this is probably where Zed and I differ a little more, is I don't see the Republican Party at the end of the day moving toward these, what he was describing as redistributive policies. I don't see them really significantly backing the priorities of unionized workers. I'm very skeptical. And, you know, we also saw very immediately, like at one point, Vance had a line in his speech that, you know, we in America welcome newcomers, but on our terms. So the question is, what are those terms? And the answer was furnished by lots of Proud Boy placards in the hall last night that read mass deportations now. Right now, the Trump pivot on immigration that happened in 2016 is what's driving most of this, what I call pseudo-populist rhetoric. And again, not to get too geeky or anything, but the historical populists are well worth studying because everyone is talking about populism as this sort of errant force on the right. And the original populists were redistributionists, and they created a new model for the American currency system that would reward productive labor and punish monopoly capitalists. It's all there in the historical record. Somehow, in all our discussions of, you know, latter-day populism, we never go back to the origins and look at what was really the last significant mass movement to create economic democracy in this country. And the fact that we're now using that term to describe whatever it is that J.D. Vance is turning into. And as you noted, he's a shapeshifter. He uses his personal life story as a launching pad for all sorts of other narratives about the future of the country and the plight of the forgotten working class. But at the end of the day, the forgotten working class is going to stay forgotten, in my view.
So I want to get a response from Zed Jelani. Yesterday, just looking at some of the tweets, progressive Texas Congress member Greg Kassar challenged his Republican counterparts to prove their commitment to workers by backing the union-boosting legislation, the PRO Act. In a social media post, Kassar wrote, "If Republicans want to talk like they're pro-worker, then let's have a vote on the PRO Act next week. Let's see which politicians are for unions and which are all talk." If you can talk about J.D. Vance when it comes to this kind of legislation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. And it makes a lot of sense that Congressman Kassar is doing that, because that's I would say, probably the highest national priority for labor unions right now is passing that bill. It would help weaken right to work. It would help strengthen, I think, labor organizing and protections across the United States. But, I think the reason why you're not going to see Republicans supporting something like that is because it would basically be going from 0 to 100, right? The National Republican Party has been extremely hostile to organized labor and to unions. Like I said, probably the past 40 years, maybe a little bit longer than that, right? And I think stuff like what Teamsters Union Sean O'Brien is trying to do is try to creak that door open, try to build that relationship so that maybe he won't go 0 to 100, but he might go 0 to 10, right? J.D. Vance and Senator Josh Hawley, who's probably the leader of the Senate populace, I'd say he's more populist than Vance for a number of reasons, both supported the UAW strike, right? The strike against the Big Three. Marco Rubio supported unionizing the Amazon workers in their warehouses in the South, in the region where I live. I mean, these are not endorsing the PRO Act, but they are steps in that direction, right? Josh Hawley was the only Republican who voted with the Democrats to defend the NLRB's so-called joint employer rule, and he would have succeeded had Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin, and I believe Angus King broken ranks with the Democratic caucus and supported the big business position in that particular dispute. Josh Hawley finally came out against right to work late last year after defending it for, I think, the first six years of his Senate tenure. I mean, political change happens very, very slowly. Think about how long it took for gay rights activists to convince the Democratic Party to endorse gay marriage. I mean, Barack Obama didn't even support it during his first term. He was, quote-unquote, evolving on that topic, right? I mean, probably he never had that position for real to begin with, but he had to deal with politics like everyone else. And so I think what's happening here is that Labor is starting to try to influence the Republican Party because they're starting from so far behind in a party that's so dominated by capital, by big business, by the bosses. They have to kind of get their foot in the door and see where they can go from there. I mean, I don't think that the Republicans are going to become more pro-labor than Democrats anytime soon. 10, 15 years maybe, but not now. But I do think that working people can't really win if they only influence one political party in the United States, right? Think about every other big interest in the United States, Wall Street, the big banks, pharmaceutical industry, AIPAC, all of them court members in both parties, right? And it took them a long time to build that level of influence. And it's not a matter of, every member is with them 100%, but they're all trying to get their foot in the door and to push them. And I think that's kind of what's happening with labor and the Republican Party right now. And look, if I was the Republicans, I would think about it this way. On one hand, you have a ton of cash from the Chamber of Commerce, from the Club for Growth, which spent $5 million to try to keep J.D. Vance out of the Senate, because big business actually does fear Vance to some extent. I mean, that's why Ken Griffin and Rupert Murdoch were lobbying Trump not to pick him. But at the same time, okay, you have all this money on one side, but look, your voting base is becoming more working class. You won the working class vote in 2020, right? Maybe you can win a few more people in the rich suburbs of Atlanta or Milwaukee or so on and so forth. Or you can actually start to lean into these workers and to start building out your base that way. The most underrepresented segment of Americans are Americans who are socially conservative, kind of skeptical of immigration, but maybe not hardcore anti-immigrant. Kind of skeptical about some of the social and cultural turns on the left, but who actually want more policy that supports workers and families. And that, I think that's the argument that Vance is going to have to make within the Republican Party. He's going to be surrounded by Reaganites. He's going to be surrounded by big donors. He's going to have John Thune and Mitch McConnell in the Senate trying to block anything that's populist. But he's going to have to make that argument to Trump, like, look, sir, if we want to be a working class party, you have to be a working class party. You can't just be working class with your talk. You have to be working class with your walk as well. And I think that would be a real political opportunity for them. But then again, it means having to shake off 40 years of inertia of the Republican Party being the exact opposite direction of all these things.
Well, let's go back to J.D. Vance's RNC speech last night here in Milwaukee.
Months ago, I heard some young family member observe that their parents' generation, the baby boomers, could afford to buy a home when they first entered the workforce. But I don't know, this person observed, if I'll ever be able to afford a home. The absurd cost of housing is the result of so many failures, and it reveals so much about what's broken in Washington. I can tell you exactly how it happened. Wall Street barons crashed the economy and American builders went out of business. As tradesmen scrambled for jobs, houses stopped being built. The lack of good jobs, of course, led to stagnant wages. And then the Democrats flooded this country with millions of illegal aliens. So citizens had to compete with people who shouldn't even be here for precious housing. Joe Biden's inflation crisis, my friends, is really an affordability crisis. And many of the people that I grew up with can't afford to pay more for groceries, more for gas, more for rent, and that's exactly what Joe Biden's economy has given them. So prices soared, dreams were shattered, and China and the cartels sent fentanyl across the border, adding addiction to the heartache.
So, Chris, that's J.D. Vance speaking last night. Your comments on what he said.
Well, it's a narrative that is in many ways true and compelling. But again, note the abrupt pivot to the idea that immigrants are driving up the cost of housing. What's driving up the cost of housing is the cost of credit. And not to sound like a historical materialist broken record here, but that is determined by the Federal Reserve. That is determined actually by the donor base of the Republican Party. So this is, when I think back on my own Rust Belt childhood, the people I grew up with were not bone deep racists or xenophobes. And what's really dangerous about this political moment in a lot of ways is that, you know, for the last 9 years, we've had a Republican Party saying, you're in distress, you're suffering, your jobs have been shipped overseas. Blame, you know, people who have come to this country by other than legal means. They are the cause. And that, again, is both a cultural pivot and a way to kind of say, don't look at the men behind the curtain. That, you know, it is ludicrous to claim that undocumented immigrants, who are also members of the working class, right, are somehow driving up the cost of housing. It's an obvious sort of pivot. It's, you know, I think Zed's analysis is largely right, but I think, you know, at some point, to really solve the problems of the working class, you first of all have to let the working class organize itself as a political force, and you have to acknowledge that, you know, immigrants are significant contributors to the health of the economy. You know, it's the reason that America hasn't had the post-COVID depression that other Western countries have, is because of the immigrant workforce was able to pivot and, you know, fill the demand once, you know, the worst of the COVID pandemic was over. So, you know, my view is we should embrace those workers. We should welcome their contributions. We should allow them to unionize. We should have them as full participants in Americans' productive life and political life.
As we begin to wrap up, Zed Jilani, if you can talk about the historical precedents of both economic populism and extreme nationalism as this coining of the term the new right with the rise of J.D. Vance is being thrown around right now. And also, remember, he's the vice presidential nominee. And who actually is going to determine policy today? Of course, President Trump, also hoping to be not just 45, but the 47th president, will be speaking. And how much power will J.D. Vance have in shaping policy?
Yeah, so both of those are great questions. First, to get to the historical parallels, look, I'm sitting here in Georgia, in Atlanta. One of our most enigmatic historical figures was Thomas Watson, right? Thomas Watson was a populist leader who at the beginning of his life believed very strongly in multiracial coalitions, right? He even organized bands of Georgian men to protect African Americans from lynchings, right? I mean, he was a powerful multiracial populist. But towards the end of his life, he became a white supremacist, became very anti-black, anti-Jewish, you know, Klan-aligned. And that sort of tracks the trajectory of what populism can be, right? Populism is often people versus the power, people versus the machine, but sometimes it has a hard edge where I think, you start to make it group versus group, you start to make it sectarian, right? And so, you know, the question for, I think, the populist movement on the right is, you know, you want to be aligned with the working class. I think these people genuinely do. You know, I know J.D. Vance's chief of staff. I met him when I was in D.C., and I think he sincerely believes in his religious convictions in particular. He's a Jewish American. He believes in the Old Testament sort of scriptures, what they say about greed and exploitation. And I think he brought that to Josh Hawley's office when he worked for Hawley, now that he works for Vance. But the question is, like, you know, do all these things apply to non-Americans, right? And I do think that this populist right movement is very nationalistic in its orientation in a way that the populists on the Democratic side are not. And I think that that often can come at the expense, I think, of the human rights of people, you know, outside the United States, whether they be migrants or they be people in other parts of the world. I mean, I think Vance has spoken a little bit about how he's worried Israel may repeat some of the mistakes that we made after 9/11, just like Biden did. But he hasn't said that we should, you know, restrict our aid or condition our weapons sales or anything else that could actually help the Palestinian people. Right. And we are largely unfortunately responsible for the situation in Gaza now. So I do think that is a real, you know, sort of shortcoming of the populist movement on the right, at least from the point of view of someone maybe who's not on the right. Maybe people on the right don't see that as a shortcoming. As to your second question, I think that's a very important question. Look, some vice presidents have a very subtle impact on the presidency. I mean, you might think about Dan Quayle like that. You might think of a Kamala Harris like that, right? I don't think that either of them were particularly guiding policy in the administration. Others, like Dick Cheney, basically wrote the foreign policy for George W. Bush. So it's a little bit of a wild card. And like I said, I think that a lot of the people around Trump will be people that donors want to put in there. I think a lot of the business elite within the Republican Party really do not like Vance. They do not like his staff and who he is as a person. And they fear that he may go in a more populist direction. They'll probably try to install their people around. Trump has reportedly wants Jamie Dimon to be Treasury Secretary, who he also wanted in 2016 but wasn't able to get. Right. You know, Jamie Dimon, I don't think, is aligned with Vance on any issue, from banking policy to worker and family policy to immigration policy. You know, Jamie Dimon's a full on, like most business elites, he wants as many immigrants as possible. You know, that's a way to reduce wages and save him money. So I think that this will be a real question for Vance. You know, how does he navigate sort of not getting kicked out of the Republican Party with his views? But also influencing them in his direction. Because the reality is, if Trump was elected and things went well, Vance would probably lead the party by 2028. He would be the front runner for the presidency, and then he would have total control over the administrative state, over the executive branch, and over the direction of the political party. But for now, he may have to suck it up somewhat and compromise when Republicans are doing things like installing people who are anti-labor across the government, when they are putting judges all over the country that are shutting down laws that are beneficial to workers and families. I mean, it is a tough compromise for him to make. And I think, actually, I want to close with this. The line that he told, that you all quoted about America's Hitler, actually is slightly different than what's being quoted in the media. This was actually sent to my college classmate, Josh McLaurin, who's now a Georgia State Representative. I knew him when we both attended the University of Georgia. And what he told Josh was that he worried that Trump would either be America's Hitler, which he didn't like, obviously. No one likes Hitler. Or a Nixon that could be sort of useful. And I think that Vance kind of came to the conclusion that Trump is sort of a Nixon figure who could be sort of useful. But he picked Nixon, I think, for a reason, because he knows Trump has all kinds of flaws and that there are a lot of problematic aspects of him as well. And so I think Vance is sucking it up and compromising a lot, some of his values and some of his views on Trump in particular, to do this. Whether it pans out for him, I think, is a big question. And whether it pans out for the country is an even bigger question.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. This is very interesting. Of course, it's just the beginning of the discussion. Zed Jelani, independent journalist. We'll link to your piece in Compact Magazine, Why the Left Gets J.D. Vance Wrong. And Chris Layman, thank you so much. We'll link to your piece. You're the nation's D.C. bureau chief. Your piece out this morning. J.D. Vance's phony populism thrilled the RNC. The rest of us shouldn't be fooled. Coming up, we look at J.D. Vance's views on foreign policy with Matt Duss. Stay with us.
Sweet honey in the rye.
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 No, it tastes like honey in the rye.
Sweet 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 Honey in the Rock, performed by Sweet Honey in the Rock with Bernice Johnson Regan, one of the group's founders. She's passed away at the age of 81. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We're continuing our look at Donald Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance. As a senator, Vance has advocated for cutting aid to Ukraine, increasing support for Israel, and taking a harder line on China. During his address on Wednesday night, he briefly spoke about foreign policy.
Together, we will make sure our allies share in the burden of securing world peace. No more free rides for nations that betray the generosity of the American taxpayer. Together, we will send our kids to war only when we must. But as President Trump showed with the elimination of ISIS and so much more, when we punch, we're going to punch hard. Together, we will put the citizens of America first, whatever the color of their skin. We will, in short, make America great again.
That was Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance speaking for the first time as the Republican vice presidential nominee Wednesday night here in Milwaukee at the Republican National Convention. We're joined in Washington, D.C. by Matt Duss, the executive vice president of the Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. Matt, welcome back to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Near the beginning of J.D. Vance's speech last night, he attacked President Biden for his support of the Iraq War, right when President George W. Bush led the United States into the war with Iraq on March 19th, 2003. He didn't talk about President Bush. He didn't say the president was Republican at the time. He did accurately say that, like Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden had supported that. But can you explain that? He himself had joined the Marines after the 9/11 attack and went to Iraq to serve in the Public Affairs Division in 2005.
Right. I think that's generally consistent with the story he's telling about his own political conversion, but the story he wants to tell America about Trumpism, about the MAGA movement, is that he was misled. He was told by Washington elites that this was a just war, a necessary war, and was lied to. So he did his duty as an American citizen and went to serve in the Marines in Iraq, but then came to realize that that war was based on a lie. And, of course, that is a very valid argument. It was based on a series of lies and untruths and had enormously disastrous effects, of course, for the region, but also for the United States. And that's, again, an area where President Biden is quite vulnerable. He was a strong supporter of the Iraq War, and to this day has never fully accounted for his support for the war.
Right, Matt. And if you could talk about some of the other positions that Vance has articulated in the past, not just on Iraq, which he spoke about last night, but also Ukraine, Israel, Iran, and of course China, which he sees as the greatest threat to the United States.
Right. I mean, I think if you look at what he's saying and what he's said in the past, you know, it's very aligned with Trump. I think Trump does get credit for attacking the kind of foreign policy establishment, the hawkish Bush administration and the mistakes that they made, but also that the foreign policy establishment more broadly, Democrats and Republicans, have made. But if you look at the actual record of Trump's presidency, it was, in fact, quite militarist. It was not isolationist. It was certainly not dovish in any respect. It was just unilateralist. I mean, and that, I think, is consistent with what we saw last night. It's not that the United States will be pulling back from the world necessarily. It's that we will be much more aggressive in advancing our own kind of perceived interests. And if you look at some of the steps Trump took with North Korea, we came closer than ever before to a war with North Korea in 2017. We were on the brink of war with Iran in the wake of the assassination of Qasem Soleimani in January 2020. There was, of course, the attempt at regime change in Venezuela. So, again, I think it's important to understand all of these in the background, even while we recognize the validity of the critique of the foreign policy establishment that we've seen from Trump and now from Vance.
Let's go to Senator J.D. Vance speaking earlier this year, because he didn't talk that much about foreign policy in this address at the RNC. But speaking earlier this year about U.S. relations with Israel and what he would like to see in the future.
A big part of the reason why Americans care about Israel is because we are still the largest Christian majority country in the world, which means that a majority of citizens of this country think that their savior, and I count myself a Christian, was born, died, and resurrected in that narrow little strip of territory off the Mediterranean. The idea that there is ever going to be an American foreign policy that doesn't care a lot about that slice of the world is preposterous because of who Americans are. We have a real opportunity to ensure that Israel is an ally in the true sense, that it's going to pursue their interests, and sometimes those interests won't totally overlap with the United States, and that's totally reasonable, but they are fundamentally self-sufficient. And I think the way that we get there in Israel is actually by combining the Abraham Accords approach with the defeat of Hamas that gets us to a place where Israel and the Sunni nations can play a regional counterweight to Iran. Again, we don't want a broader regional war. We don't want to get involved in a broader regional war. The best way to do that is to ensure that Israel with the Sunni nations can actually police their own region of the world.
So, Matt, if you could respond to what Vance said earlier this year, you've just co-authored a piece with Daniel Levy in the UK and France. There was a Gaza vote, and in the U.S. And here we have Vance talking about bolstering U.S. relations with Israel. And he was speaking, of course, in the midst the war, the Israel's assault on Gaza had been happening for several months when he spoke.
Sure. I mean, I think there's two parts of that, of what you just played, those remarks from Vance. First is what he said at the beginning about the kind of political support from many Americans, particularly Christian Americans. And, you know, I myself grew up in the evangelical church, so I can relate to what he's talking about. There is a deep understanding, a deep sympathy culturally, religiously, and politically for the state of Israel for a whole bunch of reasons. I think that is valid. It's important to understand that. But I think there's a separate conversation about what is the correct policy. If people care about Israel, what actually leads to security, not just for Israelis, but to Palestinians, for Palestinians, and for people across the region. And I think that is where we're going to have real disagreement. You heard Trump, you heard Vance, excuse me, praising the Abraham Accords. And unfortunately, the Abraham Accords are simply not a formula for genuine security. It's important to understand what the countries in the region, Israel, you know, the United Arab Emirates, some of these other undemocratic and repressive countries see the purpose of the Abraham Accords as, and that is sustaining their own undemocratic rule. So I think that ultimately is not going to be a formula either for security for Israel in the long term, certainly not for the Palestinians. I think the fact that, you know, I don't want to blame the Abraham Accords for October 7 attacks, but I will note that the logic behind the Abraham Accords, which is that the Palestinians could just be pushed to the side and kind of just managed in perpetuity, that is the logic in which the environment in which the October 7 attacks happened. We have to understand that. Now, unfortunately, this is not an area where the Biden administration is able to offer a counterargument, because President Biden himself has adopted the Abraham Accords and now, you know, kind of pretends that they can be a basis for regional peace and security,
Matt,
which they cannot.
We would be remiss in this last 30 seconds if we didn't ask you a quick question about Biden now having COVID. Biden is so close to Bernie Sanders, your former boss. We just have 20 seconds, but do you see Biden stepping aside and the significance of this moment?
I mean, it's hard to predict, but I will say that the concerns from a lot of Democratic leaderships have not gone away. That is where we are now, and I think the COVID diagnosis only adds to that.
Well, Matt Duss, want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, who just recently met with President Biden. Stay tuned for another hour of our special Breaking with Convention coverage.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Calling to all young adults, the REACH Community Health Center is holding the YAM Club, a mental health workshop focused on self-discovery, self-expression, and healing. The program is every Tuesday from July 22nd till July 23rd at REACH Community Health Center. To register and for more info, head over to reachcenter.bc.ca/events/2024.